I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from a wrestling ring or from
Carnegie Hall,
or there's so many places we can come from because this movie has so many locations here in 1999. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
I'm Phyllis Goh.
And we're about to welcome our guest, Tig Notaro, onto the podcast. But before we bring her on, I just want to say a couple things. I am getting emotional. This is our 99th episode.
It is.
Most podcasts, you know, would celebrate the 100th, but this is Podcast Like It's 1999, and we've made it 99 episodes. I knew we'd get here.
Well, no, I knew we'd get here.
That's what I mean. Like, I knew
it's inevitable.
Get here. Like, I
feel Ernie didn't.
Ernie didn't.
Ernie was on the fence. Ernie was like, you guys really want to do this?
Yeah. Right. I knew we'd get here in the way that, like, I know I could finish a marathon. It might just take me like 2 weeks. Like, I will get there. Right. I will run 26 miles, walk it, finish it. But nobody might be there at the end.
Yes.
Maybe no one will care. No one will notice. Like,
Kenny Nybert's going to finish the race,
guys. We weren't going to start this project and not finish it.
Yeah.
That being said,
we got a bunch of shitty movies we got to cover too.
That being said, we have Tig Notaro to come on and talk about the 99th movie we're doing, you know, including throwing some Friends episodes and episodes where we argue about Britney Spears and whatnot. But we've become like a thriving little podcast.
And
I'm very proud of what we've accomplished. And Phil, I got to say, I was going to say something like it was all because of me, but it's not. It's all because of you.
Well, that's not true.
You've done incredible, incredible work keeping this podcast moving and getting our guests.
I appreciate that.
Doing the research.
Thank you.
Talking with Ernie, finding Emilio.
I mean, first of all, obviously, this only works because it's both of us. And this, you know, that's what's...
I just spilled coffee as we're talking about this.
All right.
keep going. How great I am.
But no, truthfully, I do think that, you know, what's special about this is that we get to have fun together. And, you know, and that's the best part.
It is. It's been really great for our friendship as I clean up the coffee.
It's been great, not just for our friendship, but I would also say for our careers. I think it's been a lot of fun to have to reach out to people that you know, I never thought we'd ever get to sit down with and to network and to be able to sort of build relationships with all sorts of people. It's been really fun. It's been really exciting.
It's been great for me in that respect because I have no I have no industry contacts. And now
that's
I do.
That's not true.
But I'll say one more thing that, like, you know, the audience may not know. I went through a very rocky period during during this year when it comes to mental health issues. And a couple of things, like, I'm proud of. I'm proud that we were able to keep this podcast going. There's a period where we thought we wouldn't. I'm proud that Phil stuck with me. Thank you for that.
Of course, if there was any question.
And this podcast has been as important to my recovery. And I'm not going to go into it much deeper than that. I didn't, like, try to kill myself, so don't worry about that. But it's important. And it's and I didn't fall off the wagon.
You didn't.
But it's been important in my, like, recovery is anything. I've been able to come on here and talk with smart people and also Phil for 2 hours, pretty much
about things you love,
about things I love. And you've, as listeners, you've indulged that and let me go in all sorts of different directions and we've grown and, I'm proud of us. So thanks, Phil.
You're welcome, and thank you. I think that it's been a wild ride so far. We're going to keep going. It's going to be great, and we're super excited to bring on this guest, to bring on Tig Notaro, to talk about a movie that
talk about mental illness.
it's you know, and we're also it should also be said too that, you know, we're going to talk about the Jim Carrey documentary as well that went up on Netflix earlier this year, and sort of the behind the scenes of it all and what he sort of quite honestly put everybody through to make that movie. It does feel, and we'll talk about this obviously in more detail in the episode, but it does feel like Andy was a real sort of, I don't even know what the right word is, but that a real kind of lightning bolt for Jim Carrey. Like I think it changed him. I think that this movie and this experience felt like he sort of saw inside himself a little bit through Andy. At least that's what the documentary sort of, I felt, kind of illustrated a little bit.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
Okay. I mean, I think he was a weird dude to begin with.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with that. I'm not sure it just wasn't. I think Jim Carrey gets really into his roles. And I'm not sure it wasn't just another role. I know it did change him, and I know it was a really important role for him, like kind of physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually. But I'm not sure he's that different. I'm not sure that it broke him, which
I mean,
is kind of like the sense that I think they wanted us to feel. But
I mean, here's – I will just – Let me maybe rephrase it. I think that up until this point, first and foremost, you know, we don't have any behind the scenes of any of his previous films. So it's hard to say what he's like when it comes to a role in general. So it's very possible that what you're saying is true. Most of the stuff he had done previous to this, with the exception of Truman Show, were primarily comedies. Mm-hmm. I think that this movie, or at least whatever, he got rid of the shtick. From this point on, whenever I saw him interviewed, whenever I saw him on, I felt like he wasn't the same Jim Carrey. Maybe it's possible that he dropped part of the act. Maybe it's possible that he just stopped being whatever. But it just felt like it – and whenever he did do it, which was sort of sporadically, it felt hollow.
I think that happened a lot later. I do. I think that happened a lot later. I mean, he – after this –
It's myself – me, myself, and Irene and Grinch are the 2000.
Grinch, but also he was in Bruce Almighty, and he was in Fun with Dick and Jane, and he was in Number 23, and he was in a lot of stuff that he was doing that
– I mean, Lemony Snicket. I'm not saying that he didn't do things.
No, but I think he always kind of went to the MTV Movie Awards and did crazy shit like every year. I think that was kind of his thing forever and ever. And
okay.
He did – something did break him. Like, I don't know exactly what it was or when it happened, but sure. He was broken.
Yeah.
He did Eternal Sunshine after this too.
Yes.
Which, you know, I thought like put him back together, but something happened. Something broke him. Don't know what. Maybe Tig will have some insight into that.
Maybe. But either way, we're super excited to be doing this. It's our 99th episode. We've got Tig Notaro to come on for Man on the Moon. And, you know, we're incredibly grateful for everyone that continues to listen to our podcast, to keep going on this ride with us. We've got lots and lots more movies, television, music, all sorts of stuff to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Books.
Books. Yes, because Kenny loves reading books.
I have to read a book.
a book. We've got a lot to come, but it's a moment, and we wanted to, you know, we wanted to kind of tip our hat to it, to you guys for listening, and get as big a guest as we could, and I think we've succeeded, and it's exciting.
Tig has walked into the studio. Tig Notaro, the creator, star, writer of One Mississippi, stand-up comedian.
Indeed.
Host of Under a Rock with Tig Notaro.
Which we were watching earlier.
It's brilliant.
It's brilliant.
So happy to have you. It's incredible that you you came on our little podcast. Thank you.
It is incredible considering what I went through this morning to get here.
We very much appreciate it.
Yes. Tig, like me, has twins. And, you know, there's really nothing like it. Nothing will fuck up your life more.
Triplets.
You have triplets?
No, I'm saying. Oh.
That would maybe. That would probably, yeah.
Jesus. Yeah, I've got a It's Lord of the Rings stuff.
I am also on Star Trek, the Star Trek Discovery series.
Of course,
one of the actresses on there, her brother has quadruplets.
That's.
She said it's essentially an entire soccer team. Is what her nephews are.
I just don't even know how you would juggle all of that. Is that even possible?
It's hard to juggle four babies. Three is not that hard.
I think two
is hard. Three, I can't.
Two is really hard. And you know this. I love talking to the twin parents because they're the only people who understand. And anyone who has one child, it's not a real parent, as you know.
It's hilarious to see somebody with one baby. You're just like, that is
not a real parent.
Hilarious.
Don't mean to be an
it
asshole.
It feels like a cat. Like you could just leave it at the house and it would be fine.
You know, when we have one baby, we call it a purse. It's like walking out with a purse.
Yeah.
That's all. You don't even need to think. But the thing about having twins.
It doesn't need care.
No.
One child.
No. You're always involved.
Yeah.
Both parents are always involved.
Yeah.
And that is really hard.
So it's not – I mean, people say that, like, it's not double the amount of work. It seems to be just exponentially more than that. Like, you would think it would just be double, but it obviously isn't.
What is great, and I'm sure you experienced, is that one – and my sons, they're almost 3.5, but – I would say in the past month or two, they have started – they've always played together, but there was a lot of biting and not sharing and a lot of that kind of stuff. Whereas now, they get along and play together probably 85% of the time, whereas it's a small amount that they argue or anything like that. And that's where I'm like...
It never really happened for us. People said it would, but it never happened.
Oh, it didn't? Oh, see, Max and Finn are... They are buddies. In fact, you can't reprimand one without the other getting on you. Like, do not take his motorcycle. Oh, do not! And I'm like, you stop it. I am talking to him.
Oh, I mean, you can't reprimand one without the other. Like, sometimes we'll just put both in their room, and what did I do? You know, the kid will be like, what did I do? It was your sister. You didn't do anything, but I can't just punish her.
Yeah.
You know, I got to be. They have each other's back, my kids, right? They're like each other's body man almost. Mm-hmm. Like, they got in a fight with another kid, and they were both crying about it. And Layla, my daughter, goes, well, if he touches my brother again, I'm going to beat him up. And Rollins goes, my son, and if he touches my sister, he's dead meat.
That's how, like, Max and Finn are.
Yeah,
but it's with it's with us. You know, it's like we cannot reprimand the other one because the other one gets so furious with us and throws a fit if we take a toy away or send the other one to the room. It's just – it's like they're witnessing – horrendous abuse. And I start to believe
it. Abu Ghraib,
yeah. It's really, I'm like, is this intense what I'm doing?
The other thing that's so annoying, not that this is a twin podcast, this is our 99th episode. I don't know if you know this.
This is
the 99th episode of the podcast.
Yeah, sorry to twin out.
No, please.
It's my fault. We
know.
The other thing that's annoying is, like, you have these kids, you think they're going to be your best friends, but when you have twins, it's like, you're already at best number two.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, they're already.
Oh, I'm so far down the line because my wife is the most popular, and then we have a cat. Yeah,
you have a cat.
Yeah, that goes before me as well. I call myself chopped liver. And Sarah Silverman had come over to our house one day, and I was this is when the boys were two, and I was taking Max upstairs to change his diaper. And Finn was calling for me and Max to come back. And I was like, just hang out with Sarah and I'll be back down. He was like, no, I'll come. And then Sarah said to him, what am I, chopped liver? And then he goes, no, chopped liver is changing Max's diaper.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Now he's his own Hulu show.
Seriously, it's kind of a development deal.
It's so good.
That's amazing. That's really funny.
Oh, man.
Wow.
So now...
yeah. Here we are.
It's fine. I first saw you on Sarah Silverman's show.
Yeah.
Sarah Silverman program.
Yeah. Years ago.
Year, well, I always, you know, I can't think of TV. I mean, it's not an appropriate joke anymore, but I can't think of TV.
Oh, right, right. Yeah. I forgot about that.
TV, of course.
Yeah.
But, so yeah, so I've been watching you and a fan of yours. I guess that was like 8 years ago, something like that. Seven, 8 years
ago. Oh, my God.
Ago.
The Sarah Silverman program?
It was in the 2000s?
It was over a decade ago.
Oh, that's terrible. see, this is what I mean. Well, first I have no memory.
Yeah. Yeah.
Children take that from you as well.
Yeah, aren't we still in the 2000s?
Well, I guess we'll be there for 100 years.
Yeah.
But I just call like the...
I'm not good with numbers, and I'm a dropout failure, but I know so we're still in the 2000s.
So I know the date.
I'll tell you the truth. I've had... This is honest, the honest to God truth. I've had anxiety about what to call the OOs.
Mm-hmm.
The aughts?
The aughts since about 1989. Like, what are we going to call the... What are we going to call the aughts?
It's all resting on you.
Who knew?
Right. Well, I mean, you know what? It was resting on someone, and whoever that was, they failed because I just called
it
the 2000s, and I got served.
Well, I feel that way when there's a radio show, and they're like, "We play the best hits of the '60s, '70s, '80s," and then they say, "And today."
I know.
I think they're struggling with it as well.
Yes,
they're waiting for you to
punting.
Tell them.
Yeah, what are you?
What is this?
I hate the aughts. It's so haughty. It's so
well. But what is
so
what is 10 to 20? Is that teens? So we're in the teens. Is that what we are?
Yeah, we're in the teens.
We play the best hits of the '70s, '80s, '90s, and the teens.
Today and the teens.
This is perfect.
So speaking of the last year that you could actually call by its appropriate decade
99.
Name,
yeah,
99. Tig, where were you in 99?
I was in Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
and I was very new to my stand-up career. And, you know, I think like so many people, I remember being at the New Year's Eve party when it was turning 1999.
And I was just crying that I didn't know what we were going to call this
decade.
Yeah. Like,
oh. Oh, God, please.
How long had you been
fast.
In L.A. at that point?
I think I got in... to LA around 96,
okay.
97. I'm not quite sure.
Okay.
But, you know, when Prince's 1999 song came, I think everybody thinks of that, you know,
yep.
probably a lot of people. And it also seemed so far away and spaceship time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember being in... I can't remember what great. When did that come out?
I think 84.
Yeah. It was like 84.
Yeah.
The album, I think, was 1984. Yeah.
I was going to say I was in seventh grade, which I think might have been 1984. Mm-hmm. But I remember being like, whoa, 1999. Okay.
Yeah.
Have we really thought this through?
It's true.
This is insane because as soon as that happens, spaceships.
Yeah.
And,
jetpacks.
Jetpacks, everything. and then of course it happens and you're just at like a duplex, you know, blowing a and you know, your Honda Civic is outside the New Year's Eve party.
You're
and
like, this is it? This is the
year 2000? It was still the and like nothing had progressed in any capacity.
Yeah.
No,
it's been 20 years. I'm not sure that much has progressed.
I put
that
one on Bill Clinton.
Why?
He should have done a better job.
Oh, of ringing in the new year?
They should have made it a big world event.
He had his own things he was dealing with.
But he probably knew, even if you had a big world event, it's smoke and mirrors because you still have your Honda Civic hatchback.
That's true.
You know?
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
Your problem.
There's also something to be said for the Y2K of it all, too, which is that people were actually weirdly nervous about it. They didn't know what was going to happen when everything turned over. So there was like
people
this paranoia.
People are so dumb.
Y2K is one of the dumber things that we've been afraid of.
Yeah.
Clocks.
1999. Those 2 years. Just like dummies. Yeah. Dummies.
Yeah. Amazing stuff.
Yeah.
But a lot of great movies and television came out in that
transition.
Year. And we tried.
Keep it on track.
Trying. Man on the Moon. Mm-hmm. Do you remember seeing this movie in 99? Do you remember this movie having an impact on you?
I didn't see it in 99. I saw it years later.
Okay.
Were
you an Andy Kaufman fan?
Yes. Mm-hmm. However, not a fan in the way that I was a fan of other comedians, but was certainly a fan and certainly enjoyed him.
Who are your favorite comedians?
Well, you know, it changes from before I was in comedy to getting into comedy.
Sure.
And, you know, you start to understand the craft more and still maintaining a respect and love for people. But before, and again, it's not to say that the people I was into before that I'm not into now, but I would say, I mean, Joan Rivers, Richard Pryor, Ellen DeGeneres, Paula Poundstone, I loved Rosie O'Donnell. I remember seeing her on VH1 Stand Up Spotlight that she hosted, and I could not handle how hilarious it was that she would introduce herself as different people each time. She would be like, "Hi, welcome to VH1 Stand Up Spotlight. I'm your host, Nancy Reagan." And I was like, "That is hilarious. I'm your host, Gandhi." I couldn't handle it. I would say those were some comedians that I was really, really into. Paula Poundstone, I never missed a concert of hers when she was in any town that I was in. Mm-hmm. I had to go see Paula Poundstone. And what I really enjoyed about Paula as well as Joan Rivers was their ability to write the most solid, tidy joke, but then also could go with any moment and riff and be so in the moment. And then as I got into stand-up and started doing it myself, I really, really got into people like Maria Bamford and I also loved Steve Martin, now that I'm remembering that. I loved my brain's going back to other comedians that I really enjoyed. But Maria Bamford, still to this day, I would say number one for me. She's somebody that when I watch, I feel embarrassed that I've ventured into this.
I get mad. I've been mad for 2 days that my boss at work had a pitch that I wish was mine.
Yeah.
I woke up in the middle of the night. And I go, that pitch was so fucking good. I can't believe I didn't think of that.
And that it's really a confusing feeling because it's such a level of inspiration, but it's also it's humiliating that you're not that good.
You're that good. Like, that's true. I'm not just saying this. We've never had a guest who's good at anything, but you're that good.
Not Maria Bamford level. Maria Bamford is, and I'm not being, I feel like I'm good at what I do. I feel like I'm happy with myself and my career and my abilities, but Maria Bamford, that's just, it's freakishly insightful and brilliant and weird and different and her own thing. And I don't know.
Well, that actually leads to my question. I'm not a comedian, so I don't know anything about the making of jokes. Mm-hmm. I can sometimes come up with a joke within dramatic context because I consider myself a drama writer. But my question is,
so does Hollywood.
I'm not sure. Andy Kaufman didn't write jokes in the same way. Do you know what I mean? Like, when I think of a joke, it's a delivery, you know, it's a setup, it's a punchline, something to that effect. he was doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question to you is, was that inspiring to you? Did you see what he was doing? Or did anyone understand what he was doing? Like, I still don't know if anyone knows what he was doing.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when I didn't watch Andy Kaufman when Andy Kaufman was doing stand-up or whatever he mm-hmm. was doing. Or
sure.
I didn't watch him on his TV
on
show.
Taxi. Okay.
What happened was I was living in Austin mm-hmm. and my girlfriend at the time had a roommate who had a girlfriend. And that girlfriend would always – my girlfriend's roommate's girlfriend would always tell me that I reminded her of Andy Kaufman.
Uh-huh.
And I would always hear that from her with mm-hmm. different sensibilities and things that I would do. And so it was in the back of my mind. I knew who Andy Kaufman mm-hmm. was, but I didn't – I wasn't really aware of him, his thing.
Sure.
And that made me take an interest
sure.
and check him out. I wasn't doing stand-up at the time. This was just me hanging out at a girlfriend's house in mm-hmm. Austin wondering – what I'm going to do with my life. But I can't remember what your question was.
it was about sort of this, like, him, what he was doing, what his sort of the way he was, like, it wasn't jokes in the strictest sense of the word. It felt like
he was doing something.
He was playing with the audience's expectations of things
how,
like, the joke was on them. And then once they relented, then he turned into, like, a little kid. Like,
yeah.
like that was the whole thing was like, mm-hmm. how do I get you to break?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm wrong, but
no,
I'm not saying that that's necessarily what you do, but I could sort of see.
No, I relate for sure. I feel like I completely relate to that. The one thing I don't relate to is.
Hiring for your small business. If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
That side of him where you kind of don't know what's real or,
right.
or what's a character mm-hmm. or, you know, I'm never that person that
right.
is talking in a weird voice or you can't quite break through or mm-hmm. get, you know.
But would you say that, because I do feel like some parts of your act do – like that the audience isn't sure if they're supposed to be laughing sometimes.
And I always say, nor do I. I don't, I, yeah. sometimes I'm like, I don't, yeah. I yeah. really don't know what's happening. I don't know if you saw in my last Netflix special when mm-hmm. there's an Indigo Girls mm-hmm. bit there. That came from, I was having a really average show on the road. And to me, an average show is almost worse than bombing, because bombing to me can almost become comical
sure.
where you're just like, because yeah. I think in terms of, oh my gosh, I flew out to this city. This is, it's such a weird, weird feeling.
It's tragic.
Yeah.
It's like, there's nothing worse than indifference.
Yeah.
You'd rather someone hate you than be indifferent.
Yeah.
To
and
you.
I can also sure. break in that moment in with a sense of humor and just be like, I've had those moments where I'm like, I start laughing on stage. I'm like, this is so funny. You got what I thought this was really funny. And I flew to your stupid town and I'm telling you this and you're all just, how is it that you all collectively don't get it. And why did I think it was funny to pack my suitcase and leave my family? Like, I drove to the airport. I stood in line. I went through security. There's so much that happened. And and so to me, that is funny.
Sure.
Whereas just kind of an average show is just so painful. And I was having one of those. And then I don't know what happened, but I just kind of snapped in my head. And I said, I want to apologize. This show did not go great, but I have great news for you. I have a surprise guest. And then I just started introducing the Indigo Girls. And I didn't know what was coming. I didn't know I was going to keep doing it for 20 minutes.
Sure.
I didn't know. But it wasn't like, oh, Andy Kaufman is my idol or inspiration, and this is what he would do. And I'm not saying you thought doing that. But I know so many of my jokes or bits do play with that, as well as pushing a stool across the stage and making a weird noise. I've done that in front of a live audience. But that came in an authentic moment of I was in the middle of a show in Seattle, and I moved the stool just slightly, maybe 2 inches, and it made this really weird noise, and the audience burst into hysteria. That was shocking to me because it was something the whole room felt.
Yeah.
Right.
That noise made – and I think I was having an average show again. Yeah. And this is a great promotion for my tour. But I found it fascinating that I've prepared and written these things, and they're just like, next. Yeah. And then the stool makes this noise, and they lose their minds. And so I was saying to them, oh, that makes you laugh? Well, here, let me continue doing that. And then I kept pushing the stool around. They kept laughing, and then they got sick of it, and they stopped laughing. And I was like, no, this is what you're into. And so I just kept pushing it, and I did, and I continued to do that as part of my show. And in one, I remember I was in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I did that there, and I pushed it through off the stage, through the audience, out the door, across the street. The entire venue came out outside. They were standing on the sidewalk, and I pushed it across the street. Cars were stopped, and the whole audience was cheering on the side of the road. And I couldn't imagine what the people in the cars thought. Like, what the hell?
That's the best.
That's incredible.
Happening? But to me, there's a part of me also where. And it's not in a depressing way, I don't think. But I don't care. I don't care. I don't care.
That's the best feeling in the world.
Yeah. I was talking to somebody yesterday. This actress was asking, because she was saying that she had seen me on a bunch of talk shows. And she was like, how do you keep your cool? Or you always have a good story. Keeping my cool, I'm not like, I gotta keep my cool. There's a part of me where I'm just like, I care. Mm-hmm. I care, but I don't think the host is above me. I don't feel below them. I don't feel above them. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, I'm happy to be there. I have a story. I'm going to share the story.
That actually taps into something in the documentary.
Yeah, the same thing.
In the Jim and Andy documentary, the Netflix thing, about the making of, sort of the behind the scenes making of Man on the Moon, Jim Carrey says that he had an epiphany mm-hmm. where he realized that he was the guy with no concerns.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's a humor in that, mm-hmm. in that sort of...
Jim Carrey
said this. Uh-huh. And I think that there's something interesting about the humor or what an audience gets out of watching someone who has no concerns.
Uh-huh.
It's, to me, watching you on a talk show mm-hmm. doing what you do is very cathartic to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's that's the wish fulfillment for me, being able to go into a room and be completely myself
mm-hmm.
and say, all right, we're gonna have a 5-minute conversation, me and you, no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't gonna change anything, and let's just try mm-hmm. and let's just see what comes out. I can't really do that.
Don't you get can't?
Me wrong. No.
No, not really.
I can't
look how quickly was to say
no. No, I mean in the sense of both of us
can't. I can't really do that. No, I'm very performative. So,
but I mean, you can just sit here and talk. You're proving yourself wrong right now.
Thank you. I'm okay on the podcast.
Uh-huh. I mean, I'm in my own head right now, just to be clear.
Yeah, because this is like our place. This is our talk show. Mm-hmm. But no, go on to someone else. I'll be very performative. So being able to kind of – I don't know. I'm not trying to say that you are or aren't performative, but it comes off as – it comes off very confident.
Very human.
That's
very
exciting.
Genuine.
Then the Jim Carrey thing too does a completely different thing. There's this moment in the documentary where he just starts dancing and like stripping, and his whole thing I think is I'm just going to do what I feel in the moment. Mm-hmm. And the coolest part about that was I don't know. Did you watch Jim and Andy?
I did.
So for the audience, the whole idea is like he's driving everybody nuts. Mm-hmm. There seems to be one person who gets it. It's Courtney Love. And Courtney Love gets right up there with him dances with him and starts like taking off her
clothes too.
Yeah, like her robe. Yeah. And there's something so kind of exciting about him finding this kindred spirit in yesing, if that makes any sense. This kindred spirit in participating. Mm-hmm. You know,
there is something very kind of not sort of naked and raw about it, not to be literal. Mm-hmm. There's something very sort of freeing about what they're doing. I mean, I don't know how you felt about the documentary, but I kind of watched it. There were parts of me that really enjoyed it, that I enjoyed that he turned the making of this movie into an Andy Kaufman bit, lack of a better way of putting it. Like, I think that's funny and interesting. Mm-hmm. But then I think about the hundreds of people it takes to make a movie. I'm just like, for the love of God, it's hard enough to make a movie.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing in this process? But, you know, they made a good movie on the other side of it, but you just have to wonder.
He doesn't care.
Well, no, I get
that. Like, he doesn't care. If that's your takeaway, he doesn't care. No, like, if you're like Jim Carrey's kind of an asshole, he doesn't care. Like,
well, that's clear.
Yeah.
See, I don't care, but I also – I didn't connect to or relate to that, whereas I would feel like it's hard to explain where I care and where I don't, because I do care. I care. Like, I care. But I wasn't into that element.
Right.
When I thought about myself on a production, I would want to not waste people's time or frustrate people. Yeah, yeah. But I also wasn't watching it going, oh, I can't stand Jim Carrey, or why did he do this? I'm just thinking, I could not and would never do that. That part I don't really relate to. But if I'm in a show and it's my show, which, you know, I guess that could be very obviously considered his show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's fine. To me, I feel like there's too many working parts or moving parts for me to feel like that's fully my show. Mm-hmm. A movie or TV show, whereas a stand-up show, I feel like this is my show, you know. And if this amuses me or I think this is awkward enough to play with, I'm going to do that. I still ultimately want to give a great performance and have a great show, so I do care in that way.
There's nothing antagonistic about your work. Whereas I feel like
some people find it to be
really?
Some people find it to be anti-comedy at times. And
I was going to ask you about the term anti-comedy and what you think.
I don't think much. I mean, I just like call it whatever you want. I'm there's no part of me that wants to upset or irritate people. If I'm doing something, I think it's hilarious.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting when it irritates people or they thought it was anti-comedy, because I'm not an anti-comedy comedian at all.
I don't think anyone is.
Yeah.
Like, I think like that. I think that's, I think it's kind of to Phil's original question. You know, there's comedy, you know, and I put that in quotes, set a punchline.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's everything else. Yeah. Like what you do, or like what Tim and Eric does, or like what
Tim and Eric are incredible. I mean,
incredible.
Incredible.
What Megan Amram does on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. Yeah. Like, these things that, like, are so fucking funny.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And it's not real. Or, you know, or to Sarah Silverman's been doing, or what, you know, Shrab and Harmon have been doing. Yeah. Like, that's not anti-comedy. That's just new comedy.
Yeah.
It's just originality.
Oh, my God. There's nobody. I have seen Tim and Eric tank. And we did a festival in Ireland. And I'm not interested or excited to see somebody tank. But when I see somebody doing what I truly believe is the funniest thing in the world, yeah, and there's a sold out theater that I have to believe includes a lot of their fans, be silent. I'm dying laughing. I mean, I really think I witnessed one of the funniest things in the world. Whether the audience was laughing or not, what they were doing, I was just like, oh my, it makes my heart sing.
Were you in the theater when this happened?
Yeah, we were on the same lineup.
So you were like backstage or something.
Yeah. Right. And I was dying.
I can't remember whose roast it was, but Norm Macdonald, I'm sure you've seen this. Norm Macdonald set at someone's roast about how
I'm certain I didn't see it.
Okay. Norm Macdonald bombed kind of famously at someone's roast.
Oh, okay.
With these kind of anti-comedy jokes, and they were very bad roast jokes.
Okay.
Like, he told Gilbert Gottfried that, you know, when he goes to the bathroom, there'll be a sign that says, "Gentlemen, pay it no heed, because there's no room for scoundrels."
Uh-huh.
That kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And the room hated it. Uh-huh. And if I was in the room, I think I probably would have had a hard time laughing. But sitting right back and watching it on TV, part of the joy of that, uh-huh, is the room hating it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, part of the joy is that collective awkwardness on, like, right, I thought we were going to be here, like, telling these horrible jokes, really ripping people's guts out. Uh-huh. And he's calling over Godfrey a scoundrel.
Yeah.
So I think that to that kind of idea of the anti-comedy thing or the new comedy or whatever, being able to observe the audience is part of the joy of that.
I mean,
depends on your view, I imagine. From the stage, I imagine it's not as much fun.
Well, there's moments where you can kind of lose faith in a comedian if you see the audience not get it. You
right
know, where you're like, oh, they need to work on this material, or oh, this isn't quite
right.
Whereas there's people like Tim and Eric or Maria Bamford, or because I've seen Maria tank, and I'm like, nope, that's flawless what she did.
That's on
and
you.
You all need to exit the building now, you fools. You know,
sure.
Whereas if I'm struggling, I for sure am like, I'm not blaming this on the audience. I'm like, this is, I got to work on this. But there are other people where I'm like, laughter or silence, flawless,
mm-hmm,
flawless.
Here, I so forgive me, because again, like, I don't know that much about comedy, but I sort of wonder what it must have been like to sit.
I'm glad I got up and drove across town.
But you're here because I want to know about comedy.
She's here for you, Phil.
My point is, sitting in an audience with Andy Kaufman,
mm-hmm,
performing and not really understanding what's in front of you. I guess this is a long way of saying that I feel like audiences today are more prepared to sit in a show that is maybe not generically comedy, whatever that means.
Mm-hmm.
In Andy's day, I don't know what it's like to sit in the SNL audience and have him do the Mighty Mouse thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know that anyone could get it at that time. It's funny. I think it's empirically funny now, but then I just don't know if it. I mean, obviously, it did sort of work and then kind of stopped working.
Mm-hmm.
My parents loved it, which is weird because, like, God love them, kind of squares. So, like, I remember Andy Kaufman kind of being inculcated in my house a little bit.
Really?
That might be a Northeast Jewish thing. I mean, there might be a little bit of, like, he's one of us, so I kind of get him.
Right.
For my parents, but, like, they thought Mighty Mouse was the funniest thing in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but then he starts wrestling women and it becomes less funny, right?
Wrestling women's the funniest thing in the universe. I will talk about... I will talk about the, as you know, and Tig, I don't know if this turns you off, I'm a huge wrestling fan.
Okay.
And I think that
my brother was a huge wrestling fan.
Oh yeah?
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
You like him?
My brother?
Yes.
I love my brother.
All right, great.
I just wrestling is just a part of my upbringing.
Okay.
He was really into the Von Erich family.
You're from Texas?
Uh-huh.
Oh, there you go.
I mean, Mississippi, Texas.
Oh, we're from Mississippi, but yes, I... For those who don't know, Von Erichs ran the Texas territory.
And then had a very tragic...
Yes, three out of the four out of the five brothers died young.
Wow.
I think majority were suicides.
There are a few. Carrie was. I think three out of the four who died young were suicides. And Kevin's the only one who's left.
Brutal.
Wrestling's a horrible business. But part of the reason it's horrible... is because of what you're talking about with Andy, this idea of where's the line of reality and where's the line of fiction.
Yeah.
And the reason I've always liked it is because of that, is because of this, like, almost more than any kind of form of mainstream comedy, I don't know how mainstream you could really call wrestling, but it's mainstream enough. But the reason I think it's always kind of put to the side is because it's really off-putting in a way. It's very weird that a company can create a character like even say The Rock, but let's say The Undertaker for the sake of like ridiculousness, put him on Jay Leno and Jay Leno has to pretend that he's talking to a real person.
Right.
That's absurd to me.
Right.
So then you take what Andy's doing. There are wrestlers whose goal is to piss people off. They're called heels or bad guys. That's what Andy was doing in this.
Right.
He did that his whole career. His whole career was kind of blurring this line of, I'm going to push you in a direction that makes you feel something. You are going to feel something at the end of this. That feeling might be total hatred for me, but you're going to get invested in what I'm doing.
Right.
You're not going to leave, have an average show.
No.
There's not. Yeah. You're
going to. You might go home and write me a death threat, but he doesn't care. So the wrestling women is so taboo and so out there and so asinine.
Mm-hmm.
And the gall of this man to do it on Merv Griffin.
Mm-hmm. Well, doesn't it also make it very hard to bomb? Like,
He doesn't care about
that. But that's kind of my point. I know he doesn't care, but it also, like, there's no guardrails to it to a certain degree, which I think that – and this brings me to the movie, because I do feel like the movie isn't as, quote-unquote, dangerous as I feel Andy's comedy was, or at least
– Which movie?
Man on the Moon.
Uh-huh.
It feels – a little safe to me, which is maybe my biggest complaint about it. I liked it quite a bit, a lot more this time than the last time I watched it. I think it's a good movie, but I'm not sure that it totally does justice to the man or to his art or to his whatever he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's sort of – I don't know how you felt about it. Did you feel like it
– You know, I haven't revisited the movie, but when I watched it – the first time, I absolutely loved it.
Okay.
I would say, you know, there was a part of my love for it. I love Jim Carrey. Mm-hmm. I absolutely adore him as an actor. I don't know him. But it was in the beginning of my stand-up career, and I think it just was so explosively exciting to me to see this film, you know? And, but I remember loving it so much.
Maybe
if I saw it again, I'd have more issues or.
I love it so much.
Just to be clear, you know. I'm really not ragging on
No,
it.
I feel like you're saying it. Hate this movie.
I guess it's also, you know, Kenny and I had a discussion, on text a little bit about biopics, which can be tough to do. You know, to encapsulate a life in 2 hours is not an easy task. So I think that this film does a very good job at that. I did feel as though it shows the breadth of Andy's life to a certain degree. And as I said, I liked it a lot more this time than the last time I watched it, because I did feel like it was sort of – it was a little more groundbreaking, I guess, than I thought the first time I saw it. So that's the end of part one.
Mm-hmm.
There is a part two. It is coming next week.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what else to say. What are there things to say about this?
No, it was great. That was 99. We'll be bringing you 100 next week.
Big 100.
Tune in. Got a lot of exciting things planned for next week and after. That's it. Roll the credits.
Thanks for tuning in. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.